what makes a good cliffhanger? What's a good transition?
Where you're coming to the peak of the problem, or the highlight of the excitement, or where the tension hits.
That's Jules Hannaford. Her podcast is currently nominated for a Webby Award for writing. She is an independent podcaster up against some big time studios. So what writing strategies is she using to set herself apart? Find out about transitions, podcast structure, and incorporating interviews into your podcast in this week's episode. But before we get started, I wanted to first thank our listeners with a review of the week. This one comes from Anna Keenan of the Self-Made Sister podcast, and she shared it on Instagram regarding our interview with Air Commandy about how she booked out her podcast ad space for the whole year. So Anna writes, "Just listened to the episode and it was so good and filled with such valuable information, especially for newish podcasters like myself." Thank you so much, Anna, for sharing your review with us. And you know that we love your podcast so much. So any people out there listening who would like to hear from some self-made sisters, make sure to look up Anna's podcast. All right. Now, without further ado, here's more from Webby nominee Jules Hannaford. Welcome to Podcast Coaching with Christine. Here we talk about how to grow your podcast using industry insights and broadcasting strategies. On today's episode, we have Jules Hannaford. She is an author and a podcaster, as well as a teacher. Her podcast, Fool Me Twice, is currently up for a Webby Award for writing. She is up against some big contenders, guys, from Netflix and from Luminary. Her podcast dives into one of our favorite things, or at least one of my favorite things, her love life. And specifically, how she fell victim to an internet dating scam, as well as her daughter's effort to understand how this could have happened. So this podcast is an exploration of the world of sweetheart scams, catfishing, and what can be a really ugly side of online dating. So in this episode, I'm so excited to have Jules and to talk with her more about writing strategies that you can use as well to create a captivating and journalistic style podcast. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here. Yeah, thank you for having me on.
Yeah, I'm again excited. I feel addicted already to your podcast. I found out about it yesterday. I'm already 3 episodes in, and it is amazing how you're putting yourself out there. One, which I'm sure is a real struggle for a lot of podcasters who are like, I want to share my story. I don't think I have the guts to do it, but I mean, in this case, you thought about the greater good.
Yeah, definitely. I wanted to make sure that it didn't happen to other people. And I really did want to share my story, but it did take a lot of work to overcome the shame and the guilt and the sort of anxiety that came along with putting myself out there. But the rewards have been tenfold. I could never have imagined how well it would have been received and how positive the response would be, and how non-judgmental everyone was about the choices that I made. So I really have absolutely no regrets. And the biggest thing is it's been a real part of my healing. Like through the process, I've been able to forgive myself for the choices that I made, because as I was going through writing the book, I could really see how he was manipulating me and how easily I was sucked into the situation. And so being able to step back at it and look at it a bit more objectively rather than being in it allowed me to recognize that he was a professional, and that this is what he did. He was a professional con man. And later on, I found out how much of a con man he was. And I don't want to spoil the podcast. You'll find out later. I was just able to forgive myself and overcome the shame. And I'd done a lot of work on Brené Brown's kind of Rising Strong and Daring Greatly, and about vulnerability and the shame spirals and overcoming shame. And I think that helped a lot as well. But owning your story and putting it out there is so cathartic. It's so rewarding, and it's such a positive thing to do. I recommend it to anybody. I really, really do. And I'm so glad that I did it.
And you did mention that you first wrote a book on this. So you kind of went through that personal journey, that shame spiral over a series of years, because this happened in 2010 and now we're in 2020.
Yeah, I wrote the book initially. I threw out about 7,000 words as a statement for the police straight after the event. And that's where the book started. And they're like, hang on a minute, that's too long. Like, cut that down to 700, will you? I'm like, sorry, I wanted you to get the whole picture. They're like, can we just want the facts? I'm like, okay, fine. So from there, I did a bit of work on it over the 10 years. But to be honest, I felt so ashamed and embarrassed and worried for my career. Like, I'm a well-respected teacher in an international school in Hong Kong. I have a reputation that precedes me. I teach kids not to get caught in what I was caught in. So I was really, really worried about it impacting my career and people's perception of me. So it took a long time to have the courage. And so really, I actually only wrote it in about 6 months before it was published. So I sat on it and did little bits. And then I just caned it and wrote it really fast in 6 months and got it out. And it was very, very stressful. One, because of the catharsis and the facing the facts and the shame and the guilt and the embarrassment and the fear. My parents didn't even know about it. I had to tell them about it just before the book came out. And they were devastated, A, that I hadn't told them about it, and B, that I'm so alone and struggling to find companionship, and C, that I could have been killed in this situation. But I just feel that doing this really, really helped me, and I'm so glad that I did it, and it was the best thing I ever did. But I had a lot of anxiety also with the timeline and the pressure I put myself under to write it so fast. I was under contract with an agent to get it done, and I wanted to meet that deadline. Plus, I had Hong Kong Confidential. I was teaching full time. There was a lot of responsibility on my plate. And then after that, I approached my daughter and said, I really want to make this into a podcast because I'm so passionate about podcasting. I'll probably never write another book again. I did not like it. I don't really feel that I had the right skill set, particularly to be an author. And my daughter did the final edit on the book and really did an amazing job. And thank goodness for her. So then I'm like, come on, let's write this podcast. And we had to think about how to structure it so that it wasn't just like reading an audio book, because I didn't want that. I didn't just want to have me talking and mine being the only voice. So my daughter really came up with many of the ideas for the structure. Well, we did it together, but she sort of initiated the idea of her narrating the podcast and looking at it from the point of view of her as my daughter, trying to understand the choices that I'd made.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was really exciting.
And that just provided one more angle, I think, for people to connect with what was happening because of the relationship between the two of you.
Yeah, and I don't think it's that common to have mother-daughter podcasts. And also, there's many daughters out there whose mothers or fathers have been through the same thing. So I'm sure there's people that could relate to me from my experience, and then there's people that could relate to her from her angle.
Yeah.
So that's so nice. Yeah.
Absolutely. So when it came time to write the podcast, how long did that take? Like, how long? Because the book came out in, was it 2017?
Yeah, something like that, right? Or 18. Yeah.
And
yeah.
Now we're in 2020. So how long did it take to turn? Because it's not turning your book into a podcast. It's a podcast. It's a different angle, different thought process.
Totally. And it's only a particular section of the book. The book goes much broader into my life. The book is a memoir of my life starting from my childhood.
Oh, wow.
The podcast, I reckon Zara wrote it in a few months. I think she would have had it. I'm kind of like, come on. I'm like, I want to do everything really quickly. So I think she would have written the podcast in 2 or 3 months. And then I went to the US last summer and we recorded it, and I went to the True Crime Podcast Festival, and that's where I met Dr. Scott and Dr. Shiloh, and they kindly gave me interviews there. So, and Zara found Eleni Usula, who wrote Love on the Line, the book about how she was catfished and scammed. And Zara found Roger Grimes, who is a big kind of fraud guy. He's really quite famous in the fraud and deception industry. Then we went to a hotel in Asheville where she's living in North Carolina, because that's why I was in the US, because she's there as well. She's living there at the moment. And we recorded the whole podcast in 4 days in a hotel in Asheville. And then I came back and edited it and started putting it together. Now, I have an editing company that edits Hong Kong Confidential, but I really wanted to edit this myself because it was so complicated. And I'm quite a fastidious editor. Like, I drop all of the breaths. I take out all the wet mouth sounds. I take out all the noises. So I spent about 250 hours editing those 9 episodes. Yeah. And then off to sound design, this wonderful young, talented sound designer, Shade Furlong in Brisbane. And he wrote all the music. Every bit of music in the entire production is written for the show.
Yeah, well, it works.
Yeah, it really does work. Yeah, so I'm so proud of it. Of all of the things that I've done, it's the thing I'm most proud of and just so excited.
Well, what kind of feedback have you been getting from people?
Feedback has been incredible. We've been getting emails from people saying how it's changed their lives. They've realized they've been catfished, thanking us. Everybody that listens to it absolutely loves it. The criticisms that I'm getting are about the ads. People absolutely hate the ads. Well, some people hate the ads and they think that they're a scam, but in fact, they're not. One is a nutritional program that I was a part of for a while, and it did help me lose quite a bit of weight and get healthy. And the other one is a dating and relationship coach who would make sure that you weren't scammed online, and she would help you develop your skills and your dating skill set to actually be successful. But people think I'm promoting online dating and promoting a scam nutritional health program. And it's like, oh my God. So I've been getting some terrible reviews around the ads. But apart from that, there's a lot of reviews because it's been so successful or popular. But it does make me think, you know, is it worth having the ads? I mean, I was so honored to be sponsored before we launched and to have that financial support. But I just don't know whether that's a road I want to go down again for series 2. I probably will, but maybe I'll curate it a little bit differently. I don't know.
Interesting. So when it came to ads, because you're part of the network.
Authcast.
So that is something I'm sure people are curious about. Why did you decide to work with the network? And did they help you find your ads?
So I was only about 6 episodes into Hong Kong Confidential when this little thing came up on one of the Facebook pages saying, we're a network in Australia called Ozcast. We're looking for new podcasts. Send us, PM us if you're interested in being in our network. So I sent them a message, and I believe they got hundreds of messages, and they took a punt on me because they loved my interview style and the content of my Hong Kong Confidential podcast. So very unusual that they would that a network would pick somebody up so early in their career with so few downloads. But I guess they just had an intuition or a feeling that I was dedicated and they liked my style. So I joined Ozcast Network, and it turned out that it's from my hometown in Australia, which I had no idea at the time. So we've been able to meet up quite a few times and have a beer and a chat. And it was very early days as well, that network. So I came on board with these young guns from the radio industry and the advertising industry in Australia, building their own network. And it's just grown, and they're doing such an amazing job. And it's just been an absolute pleasure to be with them because they're so supportive. They help me with promotion. They are just encouraging me. Like, I can do anything with my podcast that I want. If I just put it on the State of Women Network in Florida, which is going to launch in India and Africa to share women's podcasts with underprivileged women in developing countries. So that's a great honor to be a part of that, and just to help other people and get our stories out there to marginalized communities who don't really have as many opportunities as we do to learn about these things. So they're 100% supportive. They helped me find a couple of my ads, the Adelaide Taxi one and Podvertise. They were supported with that. So that's absolutely brilliant. And I got what I asked for it. And I'm sure they got some revenue on top of that as well. But great, that's what they do. So I'm really, really honoured to be with that network. And to be honest, I did pitch Fool Me Twice around to some bigger US networks. And I actually got shortlisted to pitch it as a podcast at Pod Movement Festival for Audible. And they were considering taking it on as a podcast, but they didn't pick it up in the end. And it was like 3 or 4 months for them to decide. And I didn't really get the traction. I got some interest, but I didn't really get the traction from big networks where I might be able to make some sort of money. But Ozcast were fine with me trying and were always there supporting and ready to have me on board when I came back and was like, yeah, come on, let's do it, guys. So it's great. Oh, yeah, they're amazing. And to be honest with Fool Me Twice too, I'll just stick with them. They're brilliant.
Well, that's wonderful to kind of understand the kind of relationships that it can take when it comes to nurturing your own podcast and figuring out what your own next steps are going to be. When it comes to figuring out a network and doing pre-sales, perhaps for a podcast, which is something that's really comfortable because then you're like, hey, yay, financing.
it's brilliant. And it's also that validation, that support. Wow, look, I've got 6-5 sponsors before I even launch. That's unreal. It feels like as a podcaster that gives you credibility in the podcasting world to go, here's my podcast and look, I've got these sponsors. Mm-hmm. So, but it's also just such an honor to be supported by these different companies and to have that backing. It really is. It's a real, real honor.
So when you reached out to these companies or when Ozcast did they just share your pitch deck or their plan or what they've done with their other podcasts, or how would someone else do what you did?
So I had a sponsorship package that I created with all of the information and my rates and everything. And so the sponsorship package, which is different to a media kit. A media kit, you're trying to get media interest and articles or radio shows to promote your podcast or share your story. But a sponsorship package is your rates and what you will offer your sponsors if they come on board on your show. So I shared my sponsorship package with a few people. And to be honest, they all agreed. Like, I didn't have to hunt far. Like, in fact, yeah, I didn't approach anybody that didn't come on board. So we literally approached 5 people and they came on board.
What do you know?
I know. So that's amazing. But that's on the success of Hong Kong Confidential and the success of my book. But I still would encourage anybody to try, even if it's your first podcast and you don't sort of have something to back it up, if you can find sponsors in your niche, like in fact, Valentina Tudos, who's the dating and relationship coach, she was a perfect sponsor for this podcast. Like, it's ironic that everyone's so up in arms about her ad, but they're just not listening properly, really, I think, or we haven't made it clear enough. But I just thought, what a great fit, a dating and relationship coach for a podcast about scamming. So it's perfect for her as well, because that's what she educates people about. So I think if you can find sponsors that are in your niche and you can approach them, there's absolutely no reason why you can't go for it immediately and get people on board at the beginning. And people recognize that podcasters are the new it media thing. They are just growing, especially with COVID-19. Every man and his dog is making a podcast now, and apparently Amazon sold out of microphones. So it's just growing exponentially, and it's becoming the great way to entertain and educate, because people can do it on the go and they can do it while they're traveling to work, commuting, at work, exercising. So it really is a great way to get your message out there, and I think people are starting to realize that. So I think it's going to get easier and easier and easier to get sponsors for podcasts.
Well, I'm sure people listening are excited by that.
It's worth a try. And if you don't have any success, never mind. And that's the other thing. If you get a crappy review, don't worry about it. Like, honestly, don't ruminate and obsess over it. I'm really good at reading it and just going, oh, okay, whatever. and not getting upset about it. And I think that's very important, because there will always be people that are armchair critics, and there will people, you know, somebody said they hated the music in For Me Twice. It was only one person, but I was like, well, that's okay. Music is a personal preference. And if they didn't like the music, that's their prerogative. I absolutely love the music and I wouldn't change a thing. And that's what's most important.
Yeah. Well, I loved the music as well. And I'm not just saying that. It is very captivating and enticing. And I lean in, and I've got my husband interested. He's also a journalist. So we've both been just like listening and kind of like, this is how they do it. And so it makes so much sense. And I feel like we could change shift the whole podcast episode just to talk about manipulation tactics that people are able to prey on others' vulnerabilities and their personalities. And
yes, there's so many of them. It's crazy. But I hope that my podcast wakes people up to that. And certainly in the end of my book, I've got some chapters on red flags to watch out for and how to date safely. And it's a real sort of bit of a guide at the end of the book for people. I've had people replying back saying it's really, really helpful.
It's always wonderful when you can offer someone a resource.
Yeah, I'm a natural teacher, I think.
Yes,
definitely.
But before we talk about structure, I was thinking, you know, because you are a teacher and that is why you're in Hong Kong right now. How are things going over there just with the coronavirus, with everything that's going on? What are people's mentalities like? Are you stuck at home right now? Are you going back out into the streets? What's going on?
So we've never had a complete lockdown here. We've had social distancing. We've had all the bars closed. We've had all the gyms and pools and parks and everything closed. Everybody wears masks in Hong Kong. Like, everyone is wearing masks. At the moment, you're allowed out in groups of four. You could only buy alcohol if you went to a restaurant. So, and all the restaurant tables had to be a couple of meters apart. So they had to block out certain tables. They could only be at 50% capacity. So we've actually been doing really well. But, you know, Hong Kong shut its borders. They're testing everybody immediately who lands in Hong Kong. There's very few flights. Everybody's going to Asia World Center and being tested. Anyone from UK is being put immediately into 2 weeks quarantine there. Anybody else is on quarantine at home with a bracelet that police can track if you leave the home. So I think the Hong Kong government has done an amazing job. So we've only got about 1,092 cases and four deaths. And we're on about week 15 or 16 of working at home.
Wow.
So all the schools have been closed for 3 months. So Hong Kong shut schools immediately. So Hong Kong is really doing an amazing job, and the people are so compliant, and also our medical staff are all really trained up because of SARS in 2002. So we've been through this before. 300 people died in Hong Kong of SARS. So everybody was really well prepared for this, from the fact that there are hand sanitization stations all over the city since SARS. And the medicals, you know, we've got some of the best medical hospitals. We've got free medical care here. The testing is available to anybody and everybody at no cost. The government has offered HK$10,000 to every permanent resident to make up for some of the losses. So they've just done a brilliant job. They really have. And now we're starting to move back into the community a bit, and we're moving to groups of, I think, eight in restaurants, and we'll be going back to school, I think, in 2 or 3 weeks with a lot of measures in place. So Hats off to Hong Kong. I think this is one of the safest places to be at the moment with COVID.
Oh, well, thank you for sharing. I, as someone who's locked down in Los Angeles, I just find myself wondering how the rest of the world is doing. So thank you.
Yeah, glad things are
getting better.
Yeah, definitely getting better. And we just haven't had complete lockdown. We haven't been, like, in Australia, where I come from, they were only allowed out to the supermarket or to medical, and that's it. And they had to show proof of it. Whereas we've been given a bit more free rein, but everyone's so compliant here. Mm-hmm. They really have been following the rules. And we had everybody working from home for a couple of months, unless you're absolutely essential services.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for that sidebar.
Yeah, there you go. There's a little COVID-19 update.
At a straight from Hong Kong at 8 something in the morning.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So we were just mentioning story structure. So how did you guys come up with the story structure for Fool Me Twice?
So we knew we wanted to create a podcast, and we knew to make it interesting that it needed to have a number of voices and a number of angles. And I think that's a huge tip for anybody who's wanting to write any sort of series podcast, whether it be fiction or nonfiction. So initially, my daughter was going to write a narration, and then we were going to decide we were going to bring in expert voices and bring in scam victims as well. But then she had the bright idea of actually narrating it herself from her point of view and being a part of the podcast. And I think that adds such an exciting layer to the podcast. So then we decided we'd have her narrating, me telling the story. We'd have experts like forensic psychologists and scam experts. And then we would have a short story from another scam victim in every episode. And then it was all kind of woven together really beautifully and highlighted and enhanced by the wonderful music. And then in the last episode, I actually got to interview a real scammer from Ghana, a 24-year-old guy who's been scamming for 4 years. And I got him on Tinder by swiping right on everybody that looked like a scammer on Tinder until I was able to get somebody who agreed to talk to me. So we've got all of these different voices and layers and textures and pace and tone, and it's about changing it up and being creative and making sure that it's exciting for the audience and cliffhangers and thinking, like Zara really thought about, where do we leave each episode so that it wants people to want to come back for more in the next episode. So I think there's a real skill to structuring something and making it actually really appealing to the audience. Because many of these things are just storytelling where people write out all the research or the information and then they tell the story. And for season 2 that we're doing, we're bringing in some investigative journalism into it. So I'm actually out on the street doing some kind of spy work and stuff. So that's really exciting. So we're very excited about season 2, and it's going to be on a diamond scam.
Got it. So this diamond scam, is this something you were involved in or something that came to light? Oh, go ahead.
My friend is involved in it in Hong Kong. So it's her story, but we're still doing it in a very similar structure to season 1. But my friend will be telling the story and I'll be like the on the street reporter. And then my daughter will narrate again. So I think we've discovered a really successful formula. Mm-hmm. And so I think definitely stick with that formula.
So when you... we're figuring out, and I have an idea about this just as someone who, I was a TV news reporter, so I would interview people on the street and then write their interviews objectively into a story that would capture the attention of an audience for TV. So how did you, because I think that something that can sound intimidating for people is figuring out when to weave these sound bites together and how, so that it flows and you do meet your goals, like provide, like what makes a good cliffhanger? What's a good transition?
I think where you're coming to the peak of the problem, or the highlight of the excitement, or where the tension hits, or where the character or the protagonist is about to have some sort of revelation, or even teasing for what's to come but not giving what's to come. And I think we did that. We gave a little teaser at the end of each episode about what to expect in the next episode. That was part of it. So there's many different ways, but if you look at story structure, you've usually got some sort of problem or climax and then a resolution. So I think leaving off things at the climax or the problem is a good way to get the audience wanting to know the resolution. So dragging out the resolution is a really great way of managing the story. And also inserting these other little stories into it that are still related was a really clever way, I think, of keeping the audience's interest, because they were learning from other people's points of view as well, not just mine and Zara's. So we're bringing in different perspectives, and I think that's a really key thing. If you can bring in all of these different perspectives and voices, and then having the experts on top of that, which is really about helping us understand the terminology and the psychology behind it, it then becomes so layered. And it's those layers which make it really creative.
So you had to interview all of these experts ahead of time, right? And then you figured out how to layer in their sound bites within each episode to do exactly what you just shared, to tease, to provide one other perspective, to add an explanation or context to what was going on. So what was that process like? Did you interview those experts? Did Zara interview them? Did you do it all in a day? And then you were like, okay, we're going to transcribe this and then figure it out later.
So I interviewed most of them. Zara interviewed Roger Grimes and Elena Usala. I got Dr. Scott and Dr. Shiloh, and then all of the scam women. And I did all of that on Skype, actually. But Scott and Shiloh were in person. So what we did, Zara had the basis of the script already with the narration and my story. And then she worked out, like, say Dr. Scott would talk about what catfishing is. She would put insert Dr. Scott here in the episode about catfishing. So she just worked out where to put all of the interviews. And then I kind of worked out where to put all of the scam stories. And it was interesting because I would send the edited version of the scam stories to Zara and she would make me cut them. She was very ruthless. She'd be like, that's too long. I'm not interested. Cut that out. Or this is repetition. So she was really about tightening stuff and making it succinct and really tight. Whereas I wanted to have it all. I felt interested in all of it, but that's just me. So it was great to have her perspective as well. And I think she really took a role as a director in a way, and guided and advised on much of the structure. But I sort of, it's my podcast, so I sort of had the final say in the end, but I really did take most of her advice. And then I did more of the production side of it, the funding and all of the marketing and the editing. And so she was the writer, director. I was the producer, editor and marketer. And we had our sound designer. But yeah, it was really about fitting it all together like a jigsaw. And then I would send it to Zara and she would advise me on how to change it. Or I'd say, right, this is an intro I need. Here's Dr. Scott. He's a forensic psychologist from Los Angeles and he's going to talk to us about catfishing. I'd send that to her and say, can you record that? So she had to, we'd done all the main recording, but then I'm back in Hong Kong editing and I'm like, oh, I need an intro for this. Oh, I need this explained. So because Zara's a narrator, I've got to email her and go, can you record this and send it to me? She would rewrite everything that I sent to her to improve it, which is fine. And then she would record it and send it back and I would drop it in. And then I'd send her the episode. She'd listen, give me advice. I'd change it. And I'd have to tighten up the editing too. Like you miss things. Like you've got to go over it a number of times to make it really clean.
Yeah. So a couple follow-up questions for you. So did you use Google Docs to write these things and share them quickly? Yes. And so were you editing on a specific type of software? Were you exporting each file and then uploading it to Google Drive or to another different place? And then she'd share time code edits with you. And
so the sound designer and I were working completely in Google Drive and Dropbox. So all of I actually did a spreadsheet of all of the sounds that I wanted, and I would describe the sound. But then I let him do his own thing. He didn't follow exactly, but he had an idea of where I wanted stuff. But I gave him creative control, really. And he would send stuff back to me and I would check it. And there was only a couple of times I asked him to change the music. Like we really were in sync. And he really nailed it. And pretty much apart from two occasions, I think I've said, I don't think that music works. So we had a Google Doc with just jobs that he had to do. And then a Google Sheets with all of the time codes of where I thought the music should go. Then Bizarra, it was a bit more ad hoc. We didn't really actually even use Google. I would just send her Word documents of what I wanted her to record. She would record it and send it back by WeTransfer.
Got it.
Yeah. So we work very differently. Zara, I don't even know if she has Google Docs. I guess she does. she was invited to the Dropbox and she's a part of it, but she never used it. I don't know. It's weird. Anyway, so I had two different things going, but I would recommend Google Docs, Google Sheets, and then Dropbox.
Yeah.
Because the files are pretty big. I mean, you can also put them on Google Drive and have a folder there. But Dropbox works super well. So, yeah, that's what I'd recommend. My ad hoc method with Zara wasn't that effective.
and how did you guys – so what was your timeline? So did you give yourself 3 or 4 months to produce this based on your book? And so how did you stay on task, all three of you?
Keeping Zara on task is probably the hardest because she had a lot of other stuff going on. And I think it was a bit hard because we're in opposite time zones. So I'm waking up and going, quick, will you get this done? And it's 8 o'clock at night. And she's like, I'm tired. I want to go to bed. So I think the time zone where Shade and I were in a similar time zone because he's in Australia only 2 hours ahead of me. So we were able to work more at the same time. And I think that Zara had a lot of other jobs going on, but I reckon she wrote it in 2 or 3 months. We recorded it in like 2 weeks or whatever, 3 weeks I was in the US. I came back and did 250 hours of editing in a few weeks because I had to do it before I went back to school. So I was just editing for 16 hours a day and just getting on it. And I'd give myself a break every now and again to pop down to the beach.
Mm-hmm.
And luckily, like, I live alone. I don't have a partner. I don't have any kids at home. So it must be much harder to do this kind of thing for a long period of time if you've got children or husbands or things like that. And then it went to Shade and he took a couple of months to create all of the music because he had other contracts going on as well. So he was dedicating, like, I think Wednesdays and Fridays to my podcast, and he had other jobs on other days. And also it's super creative and he was working from scratch. So that took a while. So I reckon he was mid-August, September to October. And we released on October 25th. And we had all episodes done, ready to go at release time. And then we put them out week by week. We didn't release them all in one chunk.
Interesting.
Which I don't know is the right idea, because I really do have recognized people love a short series. They love it. It's very mm-hmm. popular in podcasting. And if you chuck it all out at once, people will binge the whole thing. And I think that's a way of them keeping track of the story. Like, I listen to podcasts every single day. And if I'm not 100% invested in the story of a podcast, it's hard to pick up where you left off. So I think there is something to be said for throwing it all out at once. But there's something also to be said for putting it out weekly over 9 weeks to build momentum in your audience and getting them wanting to come back more and giving time to spread the word. So I think that was probably the right way to do it, to get the numbers that we had. Like, our download numbers are in the top 10% of downloads according to Rob Walsh from Libsyn and his data.
Well, I think you said, how many have you reached?
170,000 or more downloads in just under, not even 7 months, six and a half months.
Yeah. So per episode, where are you at?
Like episode one's got 25,000 downloads. Or
something. You're in like the top 1%.
Yeah. It's really top 5% or something. I don't know. Initially, when it was all coming out, we were getting around 10 to 12,000 downloads a month. But also true crime is the most popular genre in podcasting as well, I think. But also my marketing skills are fantastic to the point where I think my friends want to punch me in the face because they're so sick of all my social mediaing of all my podcasts.
Yeah. Is there a tip, a marketing tip you want to share with people?
These are some of the things that I've done for marketing. I did a press release with PR Web for all of my podcasts. I have no idea whether that helped or not, but I did get a couple of media articles out of it for both of my podcasts. I had mentoring sessions with Elsie Escobar and Jess Kufferman from She Podcast. I did a VIP course with them before Pod Movement, which was super helpful. And then I paid to have Elsie mentor me another time online when I was in Hong Kong. I use audiograms. I use all social media. I'm in Twitter retweet groups, which are amazing because that gets you massive reach on Twitter. I have used paid ads on Facebook, which I think actually can really help your reach, and you can fling those ads to Instagram. Stories are great, but they're so hard to use. And I've just actually mastered TikTok and started using TikTok this week. So I put out two TikToks for my Webby Awards thing, one to say vote and one to say thank you. And they're hilarious. I love them. So I think I'm going to use TikTok a lot more because that's brilliant. It's music, it's movement, it's video. You can put all GIFs and words and everything all over it. And then you can put it on all your other platforms. So I'll use TikTok a lot more. Cross promos with other podcasts is a big one. And I had some big podcasts like True Crime Bullshit and Pretend Radio. Christy Lee from Canadian True Crime, she played my promo. She has 10 million downloads or more. So I think networking and making connections in the community is really important, but making genuine friendships and offering value, not just going up to somebody and say, hey, can you do this for me? Like, I sort of connected with everyone online and had a relationship with them. And then when I asked them to support me, they did. And I think that helped me incredibly. And then there's something else that's called a feed drop, which I didn't do, but I didn't really know. I mean, I see them, but I hadn't registered what they are and how they work. And I actually did a feed drop for Javier Leyva for his podcast, Criminal Conduct, which is out now, and that got 6,000 downloads on my feed, and that helped Brick get his numbers up. So I'm going to get him to feed drop for me twice too when that's ready, and I'll ask Josh and Christy if they will, and if they say no, that's fine, but you can always ask.
Yeah.
You know, I had my promo played on Australian True Crime right back in the beginning. They played Hong Kong Confidential promo. So that's a really good way to promote your show, probably the best.
So while you were producing your podcast, I think something a lot of podcasters struggle with is figuring out how to make money when nothing's done. So was it because you had your full-time job and was that how you're able to balance everything? Your spare time, because I think a lot of people figure, how do I do this side hustle? And you also outsourced quite a bit. So
I think one of the ways to make money is to link your podcast to a business. Now, I don't have a business yet outside of teaching because I'm teaching full time, but I'm also on an excellent wage and make a great living from that job. So I don't have that need to make the money that some podcasters who are solely podcasting need to do. And if that was the case, I would have had to have created some business that adds value and offers something to my listeners and try to make money from that business. unless you get really, really hugely successful, I think it's super hard to make money from podcasting. But it, the way that people do is by, you know, offering something alongside their podcast that they can make, whether it's make money from, whether it's like, I could, like, if I was going to do it, I could teach podcasting, I could run podcasting courses, I could teach programs on how to do sponsorship packages, marketing, media, like there's a lot of things I could do, but I'd have to package that all up and then promote that and sell that. I could chase sponsorship harder for Hong Kong Confidential. I haven't really had very much for that. I can't be bothered. I'm so busy.
Yeah, you've got a lot going on. I know that's it's something that people are they're trying to figure out, and there's a lot of different ways to do it. And I was just curious.
And the other one is to go to where your audience is. Mm-hmm. Like, where, who are your audience and where are they, and get there in person or online and connect with people. I mean, I could be going to networking events in Hong Kong and meeting people and trying to hustle for sponsorship, and I could probably do it. You know, I'm sure I could. It's a time factor, and because I'm teaching full time, I don't have the time to do it. But there are loads of ways that you can monetize your podcast, and if you think outside of the box. But this is where Pod Movement Festival and We Are Podcast in Australia that I went to was so helpful, because I learned all about funnel marketing and how to add value and how to offer. Like even Fool Me Twice, we created a Are You Being Scammed quiz. So people can go onto my webpage, do this awesome quiz that Zara put together about are you being scammed or not. I get everyone's emails, then I can MailChimp them out all my information. So I was able to MailChimp 300 people, asking them to vote for the Webbies on the back of all of the people that have done this quiz, and we've captured their email addresses. Does that make sense? So that'd be a way that, you know, if you offer something, then you grab their email addresses, and then you could try to sell to them if you wanted to.
Is there anything else that you would love to share with the audience, or, and where would you like people to find you?
I just think anybody who's wanting to start a podcast but is feeling like they have imposter syndrome, or they're not sure how to do it, or they're afraid of the rejection, or whether it's going to be received, or whether they'll get downloads, just go for it. Don't let fear stop you. There's no reward without risk, and you need to take that risk. And self-belief and confidence will come. And I just think absolutely give it a go. I'm really happy to help or advise anybody if they want to reach out to me. They can find me as Jules Hannaford on all Insta, Twitter, Facebook, and my email's jules@hongkongconfidential.net. And they can check out my podcast, Hong Kong Confidential, on all podcast platforms, and Fool Me Twice on all podcast platforms as well. And they can buy my book, Fool Me Twice, by Jules Hannaford, on Amazon.
All right. Thanks again, Jules.
Thank you so much for having me, Christine. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting to you.
Hey guys, Jules has a special gift for you. She is sharing her sponsorship templates with pricing for both of her shows, Fool Me Twice and Hong Kong Confidential, for free with Podcast Coaching with Christine listeners. So if you'd like to get those templates sent straight to your inbox, sign up at the link in the show notes. As for the Webby Awards, winners will be announced May 19th. Fingers crossed for Jules and her team. Thank you guys for listening. Please be sure to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. You can also find this podcast on Stitcher, Google Play, Spotify, and more. If you would like to email me directly, feel free to reach out at podcastcoachchristine@gmail.com. And of course, you can head to my website, christine-o'donnell.com, for frequently asked questions, the latest on what's going on in the industry, and I look forward to seeing you over there.